Well, rather than be embarrassed, I'll just go right on into this as if everything is just fine. But here's what happened. About 2 years ago, I started a series of sermons on the background of the hostilities between the Arab and Israelite peoples, in particular the Jewish people. At that time, I gave three sermons, but somehow, I don't recall why, I got sidetracked and didn't really finish what I had started. So, I do apologize for that, but I want to get back on track. I don't really know how many sermons there would have been, because this is one of those things that I study as I go, and sometimes I have more notes than I can use for one sermon, so it goes over to the next. But we might be here for a few years working on this one. But I do want to finish what I started. I think it's a worthwhile subject to consider, because not only is it an interesting history, but it also sets the stage for prophecies that will affect all of the world. So I'm going to resume the series. However, since it has been so long since we were into this, I'm going to begin by reviewing what we've initially covered. Now, I apologize because I know this will be redundant for many of you, but I think it would also be confusing for others if we were to start in the middle after not talking about it for so long. So I guess it's kind of a lose-lose situation. Whichever way we want to look at it, it'll be a little bit of a setback or a challenge, I guess, in one way or another. But I want to go ahead and resume what I had started at that time. I've titled the series Origins of the Middle East Crisis. That'll be the title for the series of sermons, and each individual sermon will have its own title. The title for today in this message is The Two Families of Abraham. The Two Families of Abraham. Now, today we're going to be almost entirely in the book of Genesis. Many of you have probably just recently heard the Foundation Institute online class presented by Dr. Ralph Levy on the book of Genesis. His book includes much more detail, and he is much more qualified to speak on that subject. But I'll try to cover at least some of the material from perhaps a little different perspective, but try not to duplicate what he's already covered. By the way, if you have not had a chance to see that class, you can go online to the FI website and do so. And if you don't have internet access but would like to see or hear the classes, let me know, and I can arrange to provide you with CDs or DVDs of the course. Now, we know that it is through Abraham that physical blessings have enriched the nation of Israel, especially in these in recent times. But it's also important to remember that there is another family also descended from Abraham. And that other family is probably even more populous, at least today, than the family of Israel. Those two families of Abraham have been, much of the time, bitter rivals. And that has affected a great deal of history of both peoples. And as I said, will also be a major factor in events that will occur at the end of the age. We're going to start in Genesis chapter 10. Genesis 10. I need to build a little bit of background as we work forward to see these two families of Abraham. Genesis 10 is often referred to as the Table of Nations. It's one of those genealogy chapters that maybe is a little bit challenging to read because of all of the strange Hebrew names, and there's not much of a story flow, just listing the names of these individuals. But it is important in that it does give a bit of an abbreviated genealogy of the family of Noah. Remember that the first nine chapters of Genesis cover more than 1,650 years of history. In just nine chapters, 1,650 years take place between creation and the time that we get to of Noah's time. After Adam and Eve were evicted from the Garden of Eden, mankind descended into violent chaos to the point that God destroyed everyone except for eight people: Noah, Shem, Ham, Japheth, and their wives. They were all destroyed in a catastrophic worldwide flood. This chapter, Genesis 10, provides a list of the descendants of Noah's sons as they began to repopulate the earth. Verse 1 says, "This is the genealogy of the sons of Noah: Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and sons were born to them after the flood." Verses 2 through 5 list the descendants of Japheth. Japheth we identify as the ancestor of the Asian peoples, primarily, as well as very likely the Native American Indians, the true first residents of North America. We'll skip down to verse 6, which begins to list the descendants of Ham. Ham, we believe, was the ancestor of the dark-skinned and black races. And we find a little more detail here. It's a couple of items of interest. We'll note verse 8. Cush, who was a son of Ham, begot Nimrod. And he began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. That phrase, "before the Lord," indicates that he was opposed to the Lord. So he was really the first villainous leader that we find listed here after the flood. And of course, he built the Tower of Babel, and we won't go into that story, but you know what that led to as God eventually scattered the people from that area because of what they were involved in and because of what they were capable of doing in the future. Notice also verse 13. Several of the names here are listed. Mizraim begat Ludiam, and so on. And then at the end of the verse, it says parenthetically, "From these came the Philistines." The Philistines, it's a familiar group of people. The word Philistine means migrant. And the Philistines migrated from the area of Egypt into Canaan. They settled in five major cities in the southern portion of what is now the Gaza Strip. But the Philistines were a constant problem for the people of Israel throughout their early history. And so that's just the first time we come across them here is where we see the origin of those peoples through descendants of Ham. Then we get to verses 21 through 31, where we find listed the descendants of Shem. Shem, we identify as the ancestor of the European, Caucasian, and light-skinned races, which, as we'll see, also includes the Arabs. And as we look at the history of Shem, or the genealogy, there's a little bit of extra interest here because we begin to come to the story of Abraham through Shem. Notice verse 21. "Children were born to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber." The word Hebrew is derived from this name, Eber. Notice in Genesis 14, verse 13, just skip ahead for one quick reference. Genesis 14, verse 13, speaking of when Abraham is rescuing Lot. But it says in verse 13, "Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the terebinth trees." So Abram was identified as a Hebrew. The descendants of Judah in particular became known as Hebrews. But the meaning of the word does not limit itself or restrict just to the Jews. It's kind of predates all of the different of the sons of Jacob, but it's a general word that would apply to descendants of Shem, in particular Abraham and his family, at least one of his families. Verse 25, just an interesting statement is made here that we don't really understand fully. It says, "To Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, which means division. For in his days the earth was divided." What is this division that took place in the days of Peleg? Two possibilities. Some speculate that this was a time when the continents were divided into the configuration we have today. If that's true, it was a huge, major geologic event. Some have speculated that prior to this time, everyone lived on one continent. And part of what God was accomplishing as he scattered the people at the Tower of Babel was to divide the people. And it may have been, it's possible, at least some speculate, that that's what the vision that's being spoken of here. A simpler explanation would be that this was the time when people divided into specific nations. They began to divide by tribes and nations during the lifetime of this man named Peleg. So that gives you a little bit of an introduction to Shem in particular. Now we want to drop down to chapter 11, verse 10, and we see some more important details about descendants of Shem. The description begins in verse 10, lists the names of several of the descendants and how long they lived and so on. But let's pick it up in verse 22. It introduces a man named Serug, who begot Nahor. And after he begot Nahor, he lived another couple hundred years. But Serug begets Nahor. Verse 24, Nahor begot Terah. And verse 25, Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. So here we see the lineage of Abram. Begins with Shem and again lists his descendants, and we see that Abram is a descendant of the son of Noah named Shem. And we come to Abram's birth here to his father, Terah. Terah had two other sons, Nahor and Haran. It says in verse 28 that Haran died before his father in his native land in Ur of the Chaldeans. Ur is a city in southern Babylon in a region called Chaldea. The nation of Babylon is sometimes referred to, or the people are referred to as Chaldeans, because that was a major region in the nation of Babylon. So they lived in the city of Ur, and at that point, Haran, a son of Terah, died. Verse 29, Abram and Nahor took wives, and they began their families. Abram took Sarai, and Nahor took Milcah, and they both married half-sisters. Verse 31, and Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son Abram's wife, and they went out from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to the land of Canaan. And they came to Haran and dwelt there. There's no explanation given here as to why Terah moved from Ur. He moved to a place that he named Haran. I doubt that it was named that already, because Haran was the name of his son who had died, and he apparently named that location after his son. Now, we don't know just how they traveled, what route they traveled, at least I'm not certain of it, but I know just it would be at least 400 miles from Ur in south part of Babylon to the northern part of north of Israel to Haran. This area where Haran is located is called Mesopotamia. That's the name of the region that that he settled in, which is about 300 miles still north of Canaan. So it says he was traveling to go to the land of Canaan, but he never got that far. He got to Haran, and they settled there. Apparently, they only intended to settle there for a short time or for a while. But it says in verse 32 that Terah lived 205 years and died in Haran. So it's difficult to tell. Perhaps they had settled there for a time. Perhaps they settled there because Terah had some health issues. But for whatever the details were that are not given, Abram's father, Terah, died in Haran. Now, the story here is beginning to lead us to Abram. Obviously, God was guiding these developments in preparation for his plan for Abram. We know, even in our own personal experience, that we can look back, many of us, and see how God began to manipulate or to guide certain events that took place in our lives, which eventually led to our calling. This brief introduction leaves us with a few questions. Why did Terah decide to move? And why did they stop in Haran? We don't know how long they were there at that location. We don't know how Terah died. It says he was 205 years old, which was actually a relatively short life for those who lived in that time. But we don't know how it is that Abram's father died. So that brings us to chapter 12. The Lord had said to Abram, "Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." That's a pretty familiar passage. It shows that God was beginning to work with Abram and had great things that he wanted to accomplish in him. Now, Abram was living in Haran with his family when God told them to leave his father's house and move into Canaan. As I said before, where they are there in Haran is 200 to 300 miles north of where Abram wound up living in Canaan. He lived in different locations there, but he was still a good deal north of Canaan at the time when God began to direct him. So again, we have some more questions that this short description would bring to mind. Why did God choose Abram? He was a descendant of Shem, and it's clear that God wanted to develop a nation that would be developed, that would be descended from Shem. God certainly saw within Abram qualities that he was looking for in a man who would be, think about it, Abram was the most important man to ever live, except for Jesus Christ. Abraham, became the patriarch of a vast physical nation. And through him, the world would be shaped through his descendants. And it would lead to the fulfilling of eternal spiritual promises as well. No one had a greater responsibility in what he accomplished and what God did through him than Abraham did. He was chosen very carefully. And we see the qualities that he developed, the man that he became, as God certainly saw within him what he knew Abraham had the capacity to be. Very important choice. Probably could not afford to make any mistakes. This had to be the one that God would be able to work through. Notice in Joshua chapter 24, a little detail about Abram. Joshua chapter 24. Toward the end of this book, which chronicles the settling of Israel in the land of Canaan, Joshua chapter 24, verse 1 says, Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem and called for all the elders of Israel, for their heads, for their judges, and their officers, and they presented themselves before God. And Joshua said to the people, thus says the Lord God of Israel, your fathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham, and the father of Nahor, dwelt on the other side of the river in old times, and they served other gods. Do you ever consider that Abraham was an idolater? Abraham, when he lived on the other side of the Jordan River, when he lived in Ur, and then later even when he migrated to Haran, worshipped idols along with the rest of his family. That was part of their culture. That's how they grew up. How and when did God begin to establish a relationship with Abraham? Certainly Abraham wasn't kneeling down before and worshipping an idol one minute, and then the next minute, God says, hey, move down to Canaan, and he jumps up and goes. There was a development, clearly, that isn't detailed in Scripture, during which God began to work with Abram to reveal himself to Abram, so that when we come again here to Genesis chapter 12, when God told him that it was time to move, he did so. And we've often commented how Abram didn't question, didn't ask, didn't wonder. It doesn't say that there was any hesitation at all. He departed, it says in verse 4, as God had told him that he should do. So we see then the development of the promises that God is making to him, beginning here in chapter 12. Let's just look at a couple of the passages that talk about those promises. Look at chapter 13, verse 14. Genesis 13, verse 14. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, lift your eyes and look from the place where you are now, where you are, north, south, east, and west, for all the land which you see I will give to you and your descendants, and I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth. So God built on the promise of Abraham, given to Abraham, expanding it to mention the vast multitude of descendants that would come from Abram. Sort of implies he's going to have a family, right? Move ahead to chapter 15. Chapter 15. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid. I am your shield, your exceeding great reward. But Abram said, Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless? And the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. Verse 4, behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this servant shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body will be your heir. The way these households functioned at the time was that if there was no son to be an heir, then the inheritance would go to a trusted servant who was born in the household. And so God is assuring Abram that, no, it's not going to be this servant who will be your heir. It's not going to be through him that the promises will be fulfilled, but one who will come from your own body. Now, you could reason, and maybe Abram and his wife later did, that God did not say at this point that Sarai would be the mother of his son. Simply that the heir would come from Abram, from Abram's own body. Now, later, maybe because of that, or at least partially because of the way that was phrased, Sarai came to a decision that really changed everything. Move ahead to chapter 16. Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. And she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, "See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go in to my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her." And by proxy, that if she gave this woman to Abram to be his wife, then children by her would be, in effect, indirectly, children of Sarah. So Abram heeded the voice of Sarai and took Hagar, her maid, and she gave him her to her husband to be his wife. Abram had dwelt in the 10 years in the land of Canaan. So 10 years after the promise had been made and then expanded at least once, Abram still had no heir. And of course, they began to be concerned and to wonder how this was going to take place. Now, Sarai, it says in verse 4, resented Hagar when she became pregnant. So Abraham went into Hagar, she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. There was a contention between Hagar and Sarai. Hagar looked down on Sarai because she was the one who had become pregnant, where Sarai had not. So there was a serious contention between them. The circumstances grew so intense that Hagar fled the household. Sarai complains about Hagar in verse 5, and Abram says in verse 6, "Indeed, your maid is in your hand. Do to her as you please." And when Sarai dealt harshly with her, she fled from his presence. Hagar was probably headed back to Egypt. That's where she had been from before she apparently became a servant in Abram's household. And on her way back to Egypt, she apparently just along the way, it says in verse 6, the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness. So maybe she was kind of just camping out and getting ready to move on another leg of her trip. The angel of the Lord, by the way, is a phrase that is used frequently in the Old Testament. The word angel is better translated messenger, a messenger of God, or one sent with a message. The angel of the Lord, you can see by the way that this phrase is used in other places in particular, the messenger of God or the angel of God is a manifestation of the Word. The one who was the God called Word, word is presents him as a representative or a spokesman for God, and logical that he would be sent to send a message from God. This is the one who became Jesus Christ. So this messenger informed her of a promise that was being made to her and to her son who was to be born. Verse 9, the angel of the Lord said to her, "Return to your mistress, submit yourself under her hand," and then said to her, "I will multiply your descendants exceedingly, so that they shall be not counted for multitude." And the angel of the Lord said to her, "Behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. He will be a wild man. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of his brethren." The name Ishmael means God hears. In this instance, God heard Hagar's pleas for help and saw her condition, the situation that she was living in that was very difficult and unpleasant. And having heard her, he rescued her. And here we see the promise that her son's descendants would be a vast multitude. This is a family of Abraham. His son Ishmael would become one who would be have a vast multitude of descendants. The prophecy here given of Ishmael is not a pleasant one. He was not promised an easy or even a pleasant existence. He and his descendants would live around, kind of on the edges of those who are great, were blessed more greatly. They would be near, but apart from the other branches of the family. And they would have to fight and scrap to make their living under harsh conditions. But they would thrive and grow into a large, multitudinous number. Verse 12 in the New International reads this way, describing Ishmael. It says, "He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility toward all his brothers." Hagar, of course, was Egyptian. So Ishmael, Abraham's son, is half Egyptian. The Arab people trace their ancestry to Abraham through Ishmael. They recognize that they are the descendants of Abraham through his son Ishmael. The hostility between Ishmael's descendants and the descendants of his brothers is a key element in the conditions in the Middle East today. The hostility between these peoples originated from the very beginning. This is not something that's going to be resolved by some peacekeeping conference establishing a state of Palestine. The hostility between the peoples goes much deeper than that. It goes to the very beginning of the families of Abraham. So here we have then the birth, or the prophecy of the birth and promises given to Hagar for her son Ishmael. Now the next thing we read here is in chapter 17, verse 1. It jumps ahead it jumps ahead 13 years. Abraham was 86 years of age when Ishmael was born. In chapter 17, verse 1, when Abram was 99 years of age, God appeared to him. We know nothing of what happened during those 13 years. We can speculate that Abraham, during those 13 years, raised his son Ishmael as the heir that God had promised. Abram's still at this point, and Sarai had felt that this was the way that God was going to honor his promises to them. As we come here, continue on through chapter 17, we see that early in the chapter, Abram's name is changed to Abraham, and Sarai's name is changed to Sarah. And now again, the promise is made even more strongly and more explicitly. Abraham will have a son by Sarah. Verse 17, we'll pick it up. Verse 15, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah, and I will bless her and also give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples shall come from her. So the promise is now made very clear. Abraham is going to be he's going to have a huge and vast family, but it will begin with his wife Sarah, not with Hagar. Abraham fell on his face and laughed, and said in his heart, shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, also bear a child? So he was, laughed. He was incredulous at the promise that had just been made. It seemed so far beyond what could possibly happen, that he at his age and Sarah at her age could actually become parents. And so Abraham said in verse 18, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. This shows Abraham's love for his son. Again, for some 13 years, Ishmael was probably taught and told of the promises that God had made to Abraham, told that he would be that heir to inherit all things that Abraham had. Now, you also have to wonder, though, if maybe Hagar shared with Ishmael the prophecies or the promises she had been given regarding him. I don't know which one may have been revealed to Ishmael, what he expected, what he anticipated, or what his relationship had become. He most likely was not real close to his mother, but Abraham loved him dearly, and actually asked God to let Ishmael be the one through whom he would fulfill the promises. But God had other plans. Now, some very human relationships and details about the lives of these people that really are not expressed in Scripture. But they were genuine people who were living their lives based as with the understanding they had and the expectations that they had. But now suddenly things have changed really drastically. And Abraham probably wasn't real pleased with that at first because of his love for his son. Remember that God had named Ishmael. God told Hagar that she should name his son Ishmael, which means God hears. And he also named Abraham and Sarah's son. He named him Isaac. The name Isaac means laughter. Laughter in joy and amazement. Remember, we read that Abraham laughed when he heard the promise that God had made. Wasn't rejecting the promise or laughing at God. He was laughing in amazement and in perhaps joy and confusion at what God had promised. And God named his son Laughter. Turn ahead to chapter 21. A little note here about Sarah. Chapter 21, verse 5. It says, Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has made me laugh, and all who hear will laugh with me. She also said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? For I have borne him a son in his old age. His name, the name of this child, was a testimony to the miracle of his birth. And when God blessed her with a son in her advanced years, Sarah got the last laugh. Out of, again, joy and amazement and just being so probably incredulous at what God had obviously done miraculously. Here in chapter 21, we see, again, the story kind of develops. Things certainly were going to change for Ishmael. One way or another, whatever he had been taught, whatever he had been told, whatever he had anticipated, probably everything changed for Ishmael after Isaac was born. He no longer received the special treatment of the only son and the heir to Abraham's wealth. Here in chapter 21, verse 8, says, the child Isaac grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the same day that Isaac was weaned. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. Therefore she said to Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, namely with Isaac. So there still was a real difficulty in the relationship between Sarah, Hagar, and Ishmael. Sarah wanted him out of the household, did not want him to be around, didn't want him to get any ideas about sharing the inheritance of Isaac, that he was to be completely taken out of the scene. Verse 9 says that he was mocking or scoffing. Mocking is the translation elsewhere or in other translations. But also, this word, the New Revised Standard, is translated playing. Ishmael was playing with Isaac. So it's really difficult to tell whether he was in some way taunting the little baby or whether he was playing with him in a more playful manner. Whatever the situation was, Sarah did not want them to grow up together. She did not want them to have a family relationship. So she wanted them to be removed from the household. And so they departed. And once again, they were rescued because they nearly died in the desert as they had been removed or kicked out of the household. God intervened to protect and to care for them. Chapter 25. I skipped over chapter 21, verses 14 through 16 is where God rescued them when they were in the wilderness and nearly died, but God intervened for them. Chapter 25, verses 12 through 18, again, show the promises that are made regarding Ishmael. It shows the list of the 12 sons that he had, and the beginning of the vast multitude that his descendants would become. So God preserved Ishmael, even though they were removed from the household. Verses verse 19, God opened her eyes and she saw a well of water. This is when they were in the wilderness and God was rescuing them. She filled the skin with water and gave it to the lad to drink. Verse 20, so God was with Ishmael. Ishmael was no longer going to be part of the household of Abram, but God was with him. God was going to fulfill the promises that were made to him. And he grew and he dwelt in the wilderness, and he became an archer. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. So Ishmael was completely separated from the household of Abraham, and he became part of the Egyptian culture. He became part of the Egyptian culture in which God would bless him with a vast multitude of descendants. Move on to chapter 24. We find what God was doing. Seems harsh and cruel that Ishmael would be removed from the household. And it probably was certainly a difficult thing for him. And an incredible change of direction in his life that had taken place in just a few short years. But we see here what God is doing. Chapter 24, verse 1. When Abraham was old, well advanced in age, the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. So he said to his oldest servant of the house, who ruled over all that he had, to put your hand under my thigh, and I'll make you swear by the Lord God of heaven and the God of the earth that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell. But you shall go to my country and to my family and take a wife for my son Isaac. It was God's intent to develop the descendants of Ishmael and Isaac separately, so they would become two distinct peoples. God wanted Abraham's descendants to be of Eber, to be Hebrews, not to be Canaanite or Egyptian. Now, some actually judge God for this and accuse him of being racist, because he was dividing these sons in this way, that one would become father of the Arab peoples, the other would become the next of the patriarchs of the Hebrew people. But that was God's plan. And we'll see, as this history develops, the importance of that in terms of what God is going to accomplish in this part of the world, and for that matter, in fulfilling his plan in general. But if Isaac is going to be of the family of Abraham, not of the family of Egypt or the Canaanites, then who is Isaac going to marry? How is Isaac going to have that family? Well, let's go pick up a detail back in chapter 22. Chapter 22, verse 20. This is a pretty important detail here. It came to pass after these things that it was told Abraham, saying, indeed, Milcah also has borne children to your brother Nahor. Abraham was separated from his family. He was told to go out of, away from his family into Canaan, where God would begin to work with him and made many promises to him. But he was separated from his family. Then he got an email or a tweet, something. Somehow he heard. He was told that your brother Nahor has children by his wife Milcah. It lists the names of eight, and then it says one of his sons, Bethuel, begot Rebekah. So these eight Milcah bore to Nahor, Abraham's brother. And then Bethuel has a daughter named Rebekah. So now there is family. Now Abraham knew where to look for a wife for Isaac. And he would send his servant to his family to search or to look for a wife for him. Now, as you read through the story, it turns out, thankfully, from Isaac's point of view, that Rebekah was a beautiful young woman. And there probably weren't a whole lot of, didn't have a big dating pool to choose from. And the servant was the one sent to choose and to select his wife. And she seemed to be a very serving-oriented person and was beautiful and was willing to come to be the wife of her cousin, Isaac. So then we come to chapter 25, verse 20. It says, Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram. Now, Syrian by location, not by ethnicity. Verse 21, Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. That's kind of an interesting, maybe an irony, that Isaac's wife was also barren. But God answered that prayer. The Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. So we find then that Rebekah becomes pregnant with Isaac's children. As we continue here in this section, the children, verse 21, Isaac pleaded with his wife and she conceived. But the children, verse 22, struggled together within her. And she said, if all is well, then what's happening? Why am I like this? She went to inquire of the Lord. And so God revealed something very, frankly, very startling to her. She was told that she was going to have twin sons. Both of them, of course, are descendants of Abraham, but they would both also be very different from each other. Two nations, it says in verse 23, are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. So even though they're both the children of Abraham and Sarah, they're distinctly different. God has something in mind for the two of them as well. Now this prophecy that the older would serve the younger is significant because in this culture, being the firstborn was very important. The oldest son had more responsibilities, more rights, more privileges than sons who were born later. And the birthright and they would also receive a double portion of the inheritance. In addition to that, there was the family blessing, which would impart the position of patriarch to the firstborn, and he would become the head of the family. Now, as you read through this section, it's clear that Esau and Jacob were fraternal twins. They developed from two separate fertilized eggs, as opposed to maternal twins who developed from the same egg. And the point is that fraternal twins are not identical. They do not share DNA as identical twins do. Fraternal twins are as if there were two distinct pregnancies happening at the same time. They're both in the womb at the same time, but other than that, they share no more similarities than siblings would who were born years apart. So this helps to explain the differences between them in their appearance and in their temperament. They were totally different people. When her days were fulfilled, verse 24, for her to give birth, indeed there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over, so they called him Esau. Afterward, his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob. The firstborn was named hairy, because he was covered with red hair. That's what Esau means, hairy. And his brother, born immediately after, they named him Grabby. Jacob means to grasp or to struggle with and or to supplant. So Esau and Jacob, born with probably just minutes apart, very different in their appearance and in their temperament. Verse 27, the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man, dwelling in tents. Esau was a man's man. Esau was a skilled and cunning hunter. He loved being out in the woods. He knew how to take care of himself in the wilderness. Jacob, by contrast, is described as being mild. This word, Hebrew word, means to be balanced or complete. He was a more balanced person. Esau was a little unbalanced in the terms of his obsession, I suppose, with hunting and living out in the woods. Jacob was more of a homebody, but he was more balanced. He was had more of a complete kind of a personality. Both were very capable in their own way. Esau was a cunning hunter. Jacob was cunning. And we see that in what develops here between Esau and Jacob. Chapter 25, verse 39. Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please feed me with that same red stew, for I'm weary." Therefore, his name was called Edom. Edom is another reference to Esau. Edom means red, and he was the color of his hair was apparently red, and the color of this stew, this lentil stew that Jacob was preparing, was also red, and so that became another name that Esau was known by. And we see a number of prophecies that refer, and we'll get to those as we go, that refer to Edom. So he was thought he was starving. What this passage indicates is that Esau really did not value his birthright. He was disrespectful, he was thoughtless, he apparently only seemed to be concerned about his immediate circumstances, and he concluded that the birthright would do him no good if he starved to death. Now, maybe I'm not being fair to Esau, but I kind of relate this to things my children would say as they were growing up. You know, when it's getting close to a mealtime and maybe we're not going to be able to eat at the regular time or whatever, they would moan and groan and cry, and I'm starving to death, Dad. No, you're not. I wonder, you know, really what Esau's circumstance was. If he was such a mighty hunter and such a skilled person, then it's hard to believe that he was really going to starve to death if he didn't have a bowl of that soup right now. But that's how he saw it. And so Jacob, being the cunning one, said, sure, help yourself. But, here comes the scam, but you have to give me your birthright. Well, again, Esau didn't see the value of it. Let me read this little passage to you in the New Revised Standard. Once when Jacob was cooking a stew, Esau came in from the field and was famished. Esau said to Jacob, let me eat some of that red stuff, for I'm famished. Therefore he was called Edom. Jacob said, first, sell me your birthright. Esau said, I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me? So Jacob said, swear to me first. So he made him, you know, swear an oath to promise to give it to him. So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way, not thinking much about it. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Next, of course, cunning Jacob and his equally cunning mother stole or took the blessing that was intended for Esau, for the firstborn. The blessing was the formal passing of the promises of God that had been given to Abraham, formally passing those promises to the next who would receive them. They were to be extended to Isaac's firstborn. But chapter 27 tells the story of Jacob deviously taking that blessing from Esau. Chapter 27, verse 1, it came to pass when Isaac was old and his eyes were dim that he could not see. He called Esau, his older son, and said to him, my son, he said, here I am. And then he gives him instruction to go out and to hunt some game and to prepare it and bring a special meal back to him. Verse 4, make me savory food such as I love and bring it to me that I might eat, that my soul may bless you before I die. So you're familiar with the story. Rebekah and Jacob cooked up a meal, took it into him. Jacob pretended to be Esau and got the blessing that had been intended for him, for Esau. Now, technically, Jacob did not steal that blessing. God intended for the birthright and the blessing to go to Jacob. He said earlier that the older would serve the younger. But he took matters into his own hand, and he took that blessing in his own way by deceit. So when Esau returned, Jacob had already received the blessing, and there wasn't much left over for Esau. There wasn't much left for Esau to be blessed with. In verse 36 in chapter 27, this is the New International Version. After Esau learned what had happened, he said, isn't he rightly named Jacob? He has deceived me these two times. He took my birthright, and now he has taken my blessing. Then he asked his father, haven't you reserved any blessing for me? Isaac answered Esau, I have made him lord over you and have made all his relatives his servants. And I have sustained him with grain and new wine. What can I possibly do for you, my son? Esau said to his father, do you have only even one blessing, my father? Bless me too. And he wept aloud. Verse 39, his father Isaac answered him, here's the blessing. Your dwelling will be away from the earth's richness, away from the dew of heaven above. You'll live by the sword, and you'll serve your brother. But when you grow restless, you will throw his yoke off from your neck. Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. He said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are near, then I will kill my brother Jacob. So we find from these early times, from the very beginning, hostilities, deep hostilities in the family of Abraham. There was a brewing rivalry between Abraham's descendants through Ishmael. His descendants realized that they would be left out. They would not be as richly blessed as Isaac. They didn't enjoy the privileges of Abraham's heir. And now Esau is determined to kill his brother Jacob for his deceit and for his cunning, and that he had taken from him what Esau thought should be his birthright and his blessing. So we see two different cultures that are developing. The culture that Ishmael is the ancestor of, and then within Abraham's family, the hostility and hatred between brothers. The resulting hostilities in these circumstances are the foundation of the clashes of cultures that occur in the Middle East today. The prophecy is very clear in its prediction of earth-shaking events that rivalry will bring about in the future. Next time we'll continue with the development of these cultures. We'll see how they affected and persecuted the nation of Israel, and we'll see some prophecies of those nations in the end of the age and how they will continue to bring about the confusion, the difficulties, the hostilities throughout the Middle East.